Hi, everybody. I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to another episode of Deep Focus, Questions and Answers, my favorite thing to do. I'm greeting you today from a hotel room in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on out here, and everybody is asking what U.S. intentions are in Iran. I wish I knew. I wish I had an answer to give them. But anyway, let's get straight to the questions. Our first one is from C. Baller. And I want to tell C. Baller, thank you very much for your very generous $50. I appreciate that very, very much. He says, hi, John, a few questions. I saw your interview with Judge Napolitano where you discussed having studied alleged CIA involvement in cocaine trafficking and with the Contras. Can you do a deep dive on this at some point? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, just 15 minutes ago, I gave an interview to the American Conservative Magazine, AmericanConservativeMagazine.com, in which we talked about the cultivation of heroin poppy in Afghanistan. We can do a deep dive on Afghanistan and Nicaragua, cocaine and heroin, and what the Chinese are doing with fentanyl. It's all a part of the same story. So thanks for that excellent idea. The answer is yes, we'll do that. Number two, while Deep Focus viewers are fascinated by your CIA stories, my guess is most Americans have little or no knowledge of the CIA's activities over the decades. If Americans were more knowledgeable about the things the CIA has done and its failures, would anything change? That is a good question. So one of my closest friends is a renowned constitutional scholar by the name of Bruce Fine. Bruce is not just a Harvard Law School trained constitutional attorney. He was also the deputy attorney general under President Reagan. This is something that Bruce and I talk about all the time. 10 years ago, we came up with the outline of a book on exactly that issue, the CIA and its failures over the decades. We both got busy and we didn't write the book, but I started writing it a couple of weeks ago, and I came up with the first 5,000 words. Now, a book needs to be between 80,000 and 100,000 words. Bruce is a prolific writer. So we've divided his part of the book from my part of the book, and it's going to be hard work, but we're going to do that book. I think the American people deserve to know what the CIA has done in their name and how the CIA has failed time after time after time. C. Baller's third question says, you've spoken at length about MKUltra and other similar CIA experiments. Most of the attention has been on the sheer horror of these experiments. However, what I haven't heard spoken about as much is the fact that they were domestic operations conducted against U.S. citizens in violation of the CIA's own charter. Can you discuss this? You've just told the story. That's exactly what happened. Not only did the CIA experiment on American citizens, but at the very beginning of MKUltra, which was at some point between 1953 and 1955 is when it started, they experimented against their own employees to the point where there was at least one and probably two suicides as a result of this kind of experimentation. You know about the experiment in the multiple experiments in San Francisco where the CIA recruited prostitutes to go out and pick up John's clients and bring them back to a CIA safe house where they were dosed with LSD just to see what they would do, just to see what they would say in response to an interrogation. You've heard about the CIA coming up with a germ that it ended up releasing into the air during a particularly foggy morning in San Francisco just to see if the germ would spread. And sure enough, 11 innocent people went to hospital emergency rooms with this rare upper respiratory infection. So yeah, the CIA experimented on American citizens without their knowledge or consent and on their own people. If I was president for a day, what few issues would I focus on? In just a day? You know, I don't think I could get anything done in just a day. I've been on record saying that if I were president, I really would try to dismantle the CIA. We don't need a CIA. And the CIA is not good at what it's supposed to be good at. It's missed every major international event since, you know, the construction of the Berlin Wall immediately after the CIA was created. It's got to go. And number five, you've spoken about how for some time prior to being arrested, your communications were being monitored without your knowledge. Do you fear this is still the case? Yes. I just assume that my communications are being monitored. Yeah, I think we all should assume that our communications are being monitored because Ed Snowden told us that they are. Maybe there's not a human being actively listening to them. They're being stored in some giant facility in the Utah desert. But yeah, we're all being monitored. And remember the lesson from Dr. Harvey Silverclade's book, Three Felonies a Day. If they want to get you, they're going to get you. And they're going to use your own emails and your own text messages and your own voicemails to do it. Okay. You know, I should add too that we've gone viral in the last week or so, especially on TikTok. I don't know how these things happen. They just happen. But things have gone kind of crazy. There's even a hashtag CIA John, which I guess is my nickname now on TikTok. I welcome it. I embrace it. But I have one hope. So please, if you're watching and you want to take clips, knock yourself out. Take whatever clips. But please give us the proper courtesy and credit when you post the clips as saying that you got them from Deep Focus. I would appreciate that. Okay. Matthew Regalado says, John, have you seen how famous you are on TikTok? Ah, there it is. It's crazy. Overnight, it seems you've become a huge source of memes and entertainment in a good way for the younger generation. What's your take? Also, on a podcast you were on, you mentioned the CIA having overthrown the Ecuadorian government. Could you shed some light on those operations? Big fan. Good to see you do well. Thank you for that, Matthew. This happened literally overnight. And it's funny, most of it came from an interview that I gave to Stephen Bartlett on the podcast Diary of a CEO. I almost didn't do that podcast. They called me on a Friday night and said that they were calling from Diary of a CEO. I said, oh, I love that podcast. I watch it all the time, which of course is true. And they said they just had a last minute cancellation. And could I fly to Los Angeles the first thing Saturday morning, the next morning? And I said, you know what? This is the first weekend in months that I don't have anything planned. I said, sure, why not? I'll fly to Los Angeles tomorrow morning. Went to the airport, flew out, did the podcast, went right back to the airport and took the overnight, the red eye flight back to Washington. I actually looked at the podcast a couple of days ago and we're up to 5.5 million views, but young people have taken that interview and they've cut it up into clips and memes and they give me, you know, the Alvin and the Chipmunks voice or, you know, the ogre's voice like this in slow motion. And it was all in good fun. And then it turned out there was an article at an outlet called complex.com entitled Whistleblower Becomes TikTok Sensation with Frequently Shocking, Sometimes Hilarious CIA Insight. A former CIA officer and Bush era whistleblower is blowing up on TikTok. It's the craziest doggone thing. I mentioned to our engineer, Chris Arnone, that one of the mistakes that I made in my own mind was thinking that, oh, I'm just repeating the same stories over and over and over for the last 19 years. That's not actually true. And it's because in my own mind, the audience never changes. And of course, the reality is the audience changes every single day. And there were people who weren't even born yet when I blew the whistle, or who were not born yet when 9/11 happened, who are just learning who I am. They're just learning about these issues that we're talking about. And so the thing has taken on a life of its own. The CIA overthrowing the Ecuadorian government, Matthew. You know what? That makes me think that we should do a longer deep dive into the CIA's overthrow of governments around the world. It's not just Ecuador. It was, you know, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, attempts repeatedly in Cuba. We could just go on and on and on. That's a great idea. So yeah, Thank you for that. We're going to do that. Okay. Latina Honeypot, that's a great name, says, "Hi, Mr. Kiriakou," and I would say, "Call me John. I love this Q&A. My family watched, and we were so intrigued the whole time by your ability to speak and keep a viewer on the edge of their seat. That's Hall of Fame worthy." Thank you for that. Thank you for all you do for this country. I have a question as well. Do you have any random funny moments you recall while undercover? There's one that I've kind of told. Actually, they turned it into a TikTok meme, but it's one of my better stories, I think. I was undercover flying from Milan to an Eastern European country to meet with a very sensitive source. Think of somebody with four shiny stars on his shoulder. And not only am I undercover, but I'm under deep cover. So I'm not even traveling as John Kiriakou. I don't think I was even traveling on an American passport. I think it was another passport. And I never talk to people on planes, just as a matter of policy. I try not to draw attention to myself, which might sound funny now. But anyway, I'm sitting next to this fat Italian guy, and he's blah, 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 the whole flight. And I'm just saying, oh, that's nice. Okay. Trying not to engage the guy. And I'm being rude. I'm like reading a book while he's talking. And he kept pressing me on what it was that I did for a living. And finally I said, in training, they taught us to say something so boring that there's no follow-up question. So I said, I'm involved in import-export. And he said, what do you import and export? I said, whatever turns things into money. I don't care what it is. That sounds kind of mysterious. Blah, 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 blah. So finally I turned to him and I said, look, I smuggle women and cigarettes from Eastern Europe. Are you happy now? And he goes, I don't think I approve. I said, I didn't ask for your fucking approval. And the guy just sat there like this, like petrified the entire rest of the flight. And then I got off, went through immigration, never saw him again. Okay, this week, Donald Trump nominated Kevin Warsh to lead the Federal Reserve. Most people saw a headline and moved on, but there's something here that's worth paying attention to. Warsh has openly supported developing a U.S. central bank digital currency, a system where your dollars exist as programmable code instead of physical cash. I spent 15 years in the CIA, and I know how surveillance infrastructure works. And I know that capabilities built for one purpose rarely stay limited to that one single purpose. A digital dollar has the potential to let the government track every transaction you make, freeze your account without a court order, restrict what you can purchase, automatically deduct fines or taxes, even put expiration dates on your own savings. Imagine that. I'm not saying that's the plan. I'm saying that is the capability. And once that infrastructure exists, history shows that it gets used. This is why I've partnered with American Alternative Assets to bring you a free report called The Digital Dollar Trap. It breaks down what's being built, who's behind it, and how physical gold could help protect your savings from a system designed for control. So go to johnlovesgold.com to download your free copy or call 888-GOLD-053. That's 888-GOLD-053 to request one by mail. Okay, Matt Menny says, "Hi, John. I've heard you say many times that a way to tell if the U.S. is going to attack another country is to follow the warships." Yeah, so our Navy is strategically surrounding Iran with the recent move of the USS Gerald Ford. Are we going to attack Iran? I'm interested to see what our president does after Venezuela. If we go after Iran, the U.S. may control two of the three top oil reserves in the world. Love the content. Rooting for the pardon. Thank you. Wishing you and your family well from Youngstown, Ohio. I was just in Youngstown 3 days ago. So thank you for that excellent question, Matt. As I said a few minutes ago, I'm here in Dubai. And I was in Abu Dhabi earlier today. People are genuinely worried because they just simply can't read Donald Trump. And I said to somebody in the Emirati government today, I said, you know, you're not the only ones who have trouble reading him. There was a reporter just 2 weeks ago who was interviewing the president, and she asked him who his advisors are. And he said, quite truthfully, I don't have any advisors. I just do whatever my gut tells me to do. And that's what makes him so unpredictable. That's why the Iranians are scrambling, because they don't know what to expect either. With that said, I was talking to Colonel Doug McGregor a few days ago about Iran's hypersonic missiles. And I said, Doug, I'm not a military guy. I don't know the details of these programs. Can an aircraft carrier defend itself from a hypersonic missile? And he said, no, there's no defense from a hypersonic missile. Well, the Iranians have hypersonics. The Chinese and the Russians gave them the technology, and they developed it internally, domestically. An aircraft carrier is the size of a city. It has 25,000 sailors on it. Can you imagine if they sank one of those things? Or even just damaged it to the point where it would have to be towed into port for 2 years worth of repairs? I just see nothing good coming of an armed conflict with Iran. And I will say, and this may be a fault of mine, but I'm an eternal optimist. I will say that both the White House and the Iranians last week said, after the first round of indirect talks in Muscat, that progress was made and that both sides are excited about the second round of talks. Now, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner were here in Dubai a couple of days ago. They were in Doha, Qatar, yesterday, and they're going back to Oman. So I'm hoping that what this means is that both sides really are serious about a negotiated settlement. And thanks for your kind thoughts on my pardon. David Summers says, hey, John, Q&A question. How do you think your time in the CIA changed you as a person? And then how do you think your time in prison changed you even further? Man, that's a good question. Nobody's ever asked me that. I appreciate your intense courage, and my family and I are behind you all the way in your battle for a pardon. Thank you. Much love, and God bless the American people. Thank you, David. It means a lot to me. How did my time in the CIA change me as a person? Listen, I was always the good kid at school. Always. I was always the kid who did exactly as my parents told me to do. I was always helpful. I was always respectful. I was always polite to adults. And when I went to the CIA, something in me changed to the point where I realized that some people, even important people, are just bad seeds. And so I came to rely on my own gut, just like Donald Trump said 2 weeks ago in that interview. And my own gut told me that I was surrounded by stone cold murderers and torturers and people who didn't give two shits what the American people wanted or what was good for the American people. And so I decided to tell the truth. And because my chain of command was made up of liars and killers and torturers, I had to go to the media. So that changed me greatly, in that I was always the good kid who went along to get along. And then I became the one standing alone, pointing the finger at people. No regrets, believe me. How did my time in prison change that even further? Listen, if you've read my second book, Doing Time Like a Spy, I say in the introduction, I can be a real asshole. I say that in writing. It actually came up in my divorce, and I had to defend the statement. But anyway, that's a different story. So I used my CIA training to stay safe and to stay at the top of the social heap. And I say in this book, I list in this book, the 20 life lessons that the CIA taught me. And I show how I use those life lessons to keep myself safe in prison. Now, some of those lessons were tongue in cheek. Admit nothing, deny everything, make counter accusations. We even used to have coffee mugs at the CIA gift shop that had that emblazoned on them. But there were other rules, like, let others do your dirty work. which I actively employed. It made me more cynical. It made me more solitary. But I'm still convinced that I'm the good guy and my detractors were the bad guys. Yeah, so it kind of honed my personality. My ex-wife would say, not in a good way, I don't care anymore. George Kuhl says, what are your thoughts on Putin being a good guy? All I've ever heard is that he's evil and bad stuff, but all I see is him being a decent Christian leader. Thanks. You know, I struggle with this. That's a great question. I struggle with this for a couple of reasons. Number one, I had a TV show on RT called The Whistleblowers, and I was twice invited to these big dinners in Moscow for the 10th anniversary and the 20th anniversary of the founding of RT, the TV station Russia Today. At both of those, I should say, Vladimir Putin attended both of those dinners. Now, the first one I really wanted to go to because Vladimir Putin was going to be at the dinner. And the judge would not let me have my passport. I was already released from prison, but I was on probation. And she said, no, you're not going to Russia to meet Putin. So she wouldn't let me have my passport. The second dinner was when I was filming that movie in Mexico, and I was already committed to the movie, and I just could not break away to go to all the way to Moscow for dinner. Like you, I have heard very, very good things about Vladimir Putin, that he's soft-spoken, he's professional. At the same time, the guy was a KGB colonel, but he's also a politician. He was the mayor of St. Petersburg. He wins huge majorities when he has run for president multiple times. At the same time, you know, we shouldn't go through life with rose-colored glasses. And he's done some things that, you know, I've objected to our own country doing. With that said, he's also a devout Russian Orthodox Christian. And, you know, I'm a devout Greek Orthodox Christian. And so I have respect for that. I can tell you definitively, we are not getting the whole truth about Vladimir Putin here. You know, one of the things I learned at the CIA was anytime somebody in our government or the media describe a foreign leader as crazy, don't pay attention to them anymore because they're not serious analysts. No foreign leader is crazy. Some are violent or brutal, or we don't like them or their politics or their policy, but they're not crazy. As part of my standard briefing on Saddam Hussein 35 years ago when I was at the agency, I would always say in response to the question, was he crazy? Absolutely not. He's not crazy. He runs Iraq like a mafia boss runs his family, right? So Putin's not crazy. He's not evil. He's not satanic. All that bad stuff is just hyperbole on the part of, you know, the likes of Lindsey Graham. He is largely misunderstood, but, you know, he's not the Dalai Lama. Okay, folks, I want to talk to you about something that really matters to me, and that is medical freedom and being able to make your own healthcare decisions. That's why I am proud to partner with All Family Pharmacy. They are a U.S.-based licensed compounding pharmacy that works with licensed providers to give people access to medications like ivermectin and mebendazole that they ship directly to your door. Let's be honest, when flu season hits or when the system gets overwhelmed, the last thing you want is to be scrambling, dealing with delays, or being told that you can't get what you and your family might need. Being prepared is not political, it's just smart. I like All Family Pharmacy because they believe, just like I do, that patients should have options. They should have privacy and the right to be proactive about their health. You don't wait until your house is on fire to buy a fire extinguisher. It's the same idea here. So take control and get prepared today. Go to allfamilypharmacy.com/John and use my code JOHN10, J-O-H-N-10, to get 10% off your order. That's allfamilypharmacy.com/John, promo code JOHN10. So that Funky Duck, thank you for the $25. Funky Duck says, thanks, John. Insightful as always. By the way, what is your take on the country of Oman? Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. The question goes on, I've heard that they are the Switzerland of the Middle East. Do you have any stories, opinions, or insights regarding Oman? Evan. So thank you, Evan. I'm actually going to Oman day after tomorrow. I have some meetings there. I have a deep and abiding respect for the Omanis, for the Omani government, and for the Omani people. They are truly a peace-loving people. The Omanis, you know, Americans don't realize it was the Omanis who got the American hostages released from Iran in 1981, working with the Algerians. It's the Omanis who have been the middleman in literally all of our negotiations with the Iranian government over the decades. It's the Omanis who will quietly call Iran and say, listen, you're not understanding what the American position is. This is what the American position is. We owe the Omanis a great deal. In addition to just being awesome human beings, it's also one of the most physically beautiful countries I've ever seen in my life. There's not a whole lot going out there. They have two major cities. Muscat is the capital, and Salalah is a beach city that's very popular. So what everybody does, they mostly live in those two cities, but they'll go camping in the desert. That's like the national pastime, is to go camping at the desert. Well, the country is just about all desert, and it's got these cliffs, these 1,000-foot cliffs that go right to the ocean, the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea. And the cities are at the base of the cliffs. So you drive, you know, up the mountains, you go to the top of the cliff, and you camp up there. It's just an incredible, stunning kind of landscape. The first time I went to Oman was in 1993. I went to brief the Omanis on Iraq. They didn't care about Iraq. Iraq is a world away from them, and the Iraqis were no threat to the Iranians. The Iraqis were no threat to the Omanis. The Omanis were worried about Yemen, which kind of surprised me, because even though they border one another, that area of the border is called Hadramut, right? It comes from two Arabic words, Khadr, which means vegetation, and Mut, which means dead. Vegetation is dead. And it's because that border area is so hostile that even animals can't live there. So I said, you shouldn't worry about the Yemenis. I said, the Yemenis are going to be busy killing each other in the coming 10 years. They're not going to be a threat to you. And they weren't. But I really like the Omanis very, very much. I look forward to going there again. Rollo says, hi, John. You are an American hero, and I wish you well on your pardon. Thank you very much for that. What can you tell us about Mexican intelligence, and how and if the U.S. and Mexico collaborate with taking down cartels? Great question. That's actually a very sensitive question. As you might expect and assume, cooperation is robust. It's very healthy. Listen, Mexican intelligence is not infiltrated by the cartels. They're like the federales. They're true believers. They're people you can trust, people you can work with. At the same time, their hands are tied, because most of their country is like a no-go area for them, just like it is for the federales. And so that's one of the reasons why they aren't able to make more progress than they already have. They just have to play the hand that they've been dealt and hope for the best. One of the things that they're particularly good at is electronic intelligence, and that's something that we work with them closely on. But I don't think they're able to take down the cartels, nor are we. We just have to keep working, keep fighting the good fight, and hope for the best. Ayup A, thank you very much for the 100, I don't know, Turkish lira? Thank you. Whatever it is, thank you very much. Says, could you name some of the people that influenced you the most, made you John Kiriakou of today throughout your life? Could be in an artist, commander, family, friend, politician, writer. Thank you for asking that question. That's a lovely question. And I can name you three people. two are going to be kind of cliche, but my father and my grandfather, my father's father. Growing up, my grandfather was my best friend growing up. And he had only a third grade education. And because he was not educated, he stressed education for his own children. My father had one sister. My father got a bachelor's degree in education, a master's degree in music, and a PhD in music education. My aunt, his older sister, got a bachelor's degree in nursing, a master's degree in nursing, and a PhD in hospital administration. This is while having a father educated at the third grade level. It was my grandfather who introduced me to, you know, Alexander the Great. It was my grandfather who, you know, found an 11th century gold coin while digging up his garden in Greece, and then gave me this gold coin, which I still treasure today, while giving me the history of the emperor whose image appears on the coin. My grandfather was, and my dad, you know, I'll tell you a story about my dad. My dad was an elementary school principal. I really believe too, looking back on my life, this was what made me a whistleblower. My dad was an elementary school principal, a really good one. Anytime there was a school that really needed to be cleaned up, they would send my dad. And in 2 or 3 years, he would have that place spinning like a top. So he applied for a position as the high school principal. And he was interviewed by the school board, of course. And I remember him saying, I was in sixth grade at the time, so I was like 11. And I remember him saying, well, if I get the job, they'll call tonight. And I went to bed. I woke up in the middle of the night to get a drink of water. And I woke up my dad and I said, Dad, did they call? And he said, no, they didn't call. I didn't get the job. Well, 3 years later, the job of the position of deputy, or not deputy, assistant superintendent opened up. And my dad had superintendent's certification. So he applied for that job. And same thing. He said, well, if I get the job, they'll call tonight. And I stayed up that night until almost 11. And I said, Dad, they didn't call again. And he said, no, I knew they weren't going to call. I'm never going to get one of these jobs. And I said, why not? Because he was clearly, I mean, not just because he was my dad, he was clearly the best qualified, the smartest person for these jobs. And he said, I'm not going to get the job because I won't pay the bribe that they're demanding. He said, the members of the school board are demanding bribes and I'm just not going to pay it. He said, I could, but it's not honest. And I won't take a job that I get by taking a bribe. That stuck like glue in my mind for the rest of my life. This was almost 50 years ago. It was 50 years ago. But my dad would not pay a bribe, and he paid with it, for it, with his career. That's something that I'm very proud of. Our last question is from David Perella, who says, how good of a poker player are you? How did you know that that is like the national pastime of all CIA case officers, to play poker with each other? In fact, when I was in Arabic training, we played poker in Arabic. When we were on our language immersions, you were allowed to speak any English. I'm actually a good poker player. I mean, we're all like, you know, straight-faced, poker-faced, you know, half of us are sociopaths. So we're all generally good poker players. But I'll tell you, I was such a good poker player that when we would play at the farm, I would always win enough for my tank of gas to go back home. I never had to pay for my own gas. Yeah, I won all the time. I was in kind of a relatively high stakes game once in Sofia, Bulgaria, and I won a ton of money. I think I ended up donating it. Like, I went to a Bulgarian Orthodox church and just dumped it in the tray. Yeah, so I'm a good poker player, but man, that's something that everybody does while there. So those are the questions that we have tonight. You know, I have said in the past that, oh, go ahead and throw in a question. We answer all the questions. We can't anymore. There are literally hundreds of questions. So we're taking out, we're pulling some of the most diverse questions and putting them in so we can sort of get a flavor of what everybody's thinking out there. Thank you. for subscribing, for liking, for sharing, and for talking about the show. It really means a lot to me. And I look forward to doing this again for the next Q&A. All the best. Bye-bye.